so you don't see a lot of Jews with dogs. Well, you begin to see why in the Old Testament, or well, throughout the Bible, that dogs are never spoken of as, you know, a pet or Fido as we have them around our houses. They're, and for that reason, and in the Old Testament especially, it's simply the dogs are scavengers. They clean up the refuse and the garbage that people throw out into the streets. They have sewer systems. Everything just went in the street. So the packs of dogs would roam at night eating it all up. So you can understand why dogs would not have exactly the same connotation. But anyway, thank you, Jake, for researching that for us. That was intriguing, to say the least. Interesting. We know what not to get a Jewish friend. Don't get them a... Get them a puppy for Christmas. Yeah, that would go over great. Yeah. Okay, Psalm number 60. Let me read this psalm before we look at it. Let me start with the inscription. Follow along as I read. To the chief musician upon Shushan Iduk, Michtam, Michtam of David, to teach when he strove with Aram Naharaim and with Aram Zobah, when Joab returned and smote of Edom in the Valley of Salt 12,000. Quite an inscription. And then the psalm. O God, Thou hast cast us off. Thou hast scattered us. Thou hast been displeased. O turn Thyself to us again. Thou hast made the earth to tremble. Thou hast broken it. Heal the breaches thereof, for it shaketh. Thou hast given a banner to them that fear thee, that it may be I skipped a verse, didn't I? Verse 3. Thou hast shown thy people hard things. Thou hast made us to drink the wine of astonishment. Thou hast given a banner to them that fear thee, that it may be displayed because of the truth, Selah. That thy beloved may be delivered, save with thy right hand, and hear me. God hath spoken in his holiness, I will rejoice. I will divide Shechem, and meet the valley of Succoth. Gilead is mine, and Manasseh is mine. Ephraim also is the strength of mine head. Judah is my lawgiver. Moab is my washpot. Over Edom will I cast out my shoe. Philistia, triumph thou because of me. Who will bring me into the strong city? Who will lead me into Edom? Wilt not thou, O God, who hadst cast us off, and thou, O God, who didst not go out with our armies, give us help from trouble? For vain is the help of man. Through God we shall do valiantly, for it is He who shall tread down our enemies." Well, first of all, it is dedicated again to the chief musician to be apparently sung to a tune, this Shushanaduk, which means the lily of testimony. Jake, anything to add about that? Okay. Don't know what it sounded like, or. Yeah. So they just sort of minimize this. Yeah. They're not interested. But in other words, it may be a tune, maybe an instrument that they think it's an instrument. The truth is nobody knows for certain, probably. And notice that it is yet another one of these mishtam, these golden psalms. There's a whole series of them, and this is yet another in that series. And it is supposed to have been written upon an incident that is being described here in the inscription. Now, let me try to bring you up to speed on what this is talking about. You may remember that when David was more or less confirmed as king of all Israel, Israel was brought under his dominion. We've been studying that on Tuesday morning, the process by which that happened. He reigned 7 years in the city of Hebron, and then another 33 years in Jerusalem over all Israel. But one of the neighboring nations was the nation of Moab. And if we were in downtown Jerusalem, the children of Ammon, they would be roughly where Holly Springs, Mississippi is. They'd be across the Jordan River, right on the other side, and about as far as Holly Springs is from us, that's where the Ammonites would live. So it's not that far away, just across the Jordan River Valley. And the king of the Ammonites died, and his son, Hanun, they had a big funeral for the king of Ammon, and David sent his emissaries, his representatives, to go to the funeral, to mourn this fellow who had died. Well, some of Hanun is the son of the king that died, so he's the new king. Some of his advisors said, look, David sent these men down here. They're not coming down here to mourn your father. They're coming down here to spy out the land. And so Hanun took these representatives of David and did a very shameful thing. He stripped them halfway. It's sort of like if you drew a line right down the back of their head, right down the back of their back. He stripped them naked on one side and shaved all the hair off of them on one side. And then sent them on their way. Now, can you imagine? Well, that was a very shameful thing to do. And in fact, when they got back across the Jordan River, David sent word, just stay where you are and wait till your hair grows back out before you come back into the culture again. But this was a grievous insult. And Hanun realized once he had done this that, as we say, this means war. But Hanun then hires a bunch of Syrian mercenaries to come down and to fight with the Ammonites. In other words, you've got an army of Ammonites that is under the command of Hanun, and you've got a bunch of Syrians, and the Syrians are the Aramaics. That's where the Aram here. The Aramea is a general broad term for Syria. You'll notice there are two Arams here. One is Aram Naharaim. That means Syria between the rivers, and that's talking about the part of Syria that would have been between the Euphrates and Tigris rivers, the upper part of what we call Mesopotamia. And then there is another Aram here, Aram Zobah. Zobah was a small kingdom up in the area near Damascus. And so you have these various tribes of Syrians that have been hired by the king of Ammon to come down and to defend the Ammonites against the attack of David and his men. And it's an interesting story. We don't have time to go into all the details. But we read of Joab and Abishai, his brother, taking part of the army. And one of them, Joab, attacked the group of the Syrians, and Abishai attacked the Ammonites, and they had an agreement between the two of them. If I get in trouble, you'll come to my aid, and if you get in trouble, I'll come to your aid. And then while all of that's going on, apparently the Edomites, now the Edomites lived, if we're in Jerusalem, the Edomites would have lived about where Grenada, Mississippi is, about 100 miles straight south. The Edomites took advantage of the fact that Israel was tied up in this war with the Syrians to invade the south. And we learn that later that Joab and Abishai go down and meet the Edomite army in what is called the Valley of the Salt. It is assumed that the Valley of Salt was the southern end of the Dead Sea. In fact, there's an entire mountain of salt. I read the account of an early traveler in Israel, and he said it's just almost unbelievable. This whole mountain is basically a mountain of salt. And he said they broke pieces off and would feel it and taste it. And it has little ruts in it where the water has run down and dissolved some of the salt. And this whole area, of course, the Dead Sea is very salty. So there's just this whole area there around this mountain of salt that they call the Valley of Salt. And in that valley, Joab and Abishai defeat the Edomites. And so they not only have defeated the Ammonites, they've defeated the Syrians, and now they defeat the Edomites. In other words, all of their perennial enemies over there on the east side of the Jordan River have now been subdued to David. And that pretty well ends the threats. They had already subdued the Philistines, which were the people they fought against all the time. Now they've defeated the Edomites, they've defeated the Ammonites, they've defeated the Syrians to the north, up towards Damascus, Syria. So the entire region over there on the what's called the Transjordan, over on the east side of the Jordan River, has now been brought under the power of King David. So now David is not only king, he reigned first for 7 years over Judah, then the next 33 years he reigns over all Israel. Now he extends his reign outside the borders of Israel. You have these tributary states that now have to pay tribute to him because he has conquered them. So all of the enemies that have surrounded him have now been subdued and brought under his control. And so rather than this being a psalm, and I think the inscription may be somewhat misleading in that it would sound like that this is a psalm written to commemorate these battles. I think that once you study this psalm, it appears to be instead a sort of a survey looking backwards from the time that David has come to the kingdom, from the time that Saul was slain on Mount Gibeah to the point where all these enemies now have been subdued under the kingship of David. In other words, it's looking back over that whole process of how David's kingdom just expands and expands and expands. And I think that's how to make the most sense out of the psalm. I think things fall in place once you look at it that way. So let's look at it from that angle. We'll look at the first three verses which speak of the trouble that Israel is in when David first comes on the scene. Then from verses 4 to 10, we look at the deliverance that God has blessed them with. And then finally, we look at the lessons learned in the last two verses of the psalm. So we'll sort of approach it like that. First of all, in verses 1 through 3, as I said, it seems to look back to the situation in Israel at the time of Saul's death. Notice that the description is that God has deserted them. They are scattered. And notice the earth is shaking, it's trembling, there are breaches in the land, and the people have drunk the wine of astonishment. They are, we would say, the news staggers them. That's a way of expressing it. Now notice the oftentimes natural phenomena is used, like shaking, like an earthquake, or a breach that is a division, to illustrate a political calamity. When you have one dynasty being brought to an end and replaced by another dynasty. Y'all know what I mean by dynasty? For instance, in England, they have the royal family. You might know their last name. The House of Windsor. They're actually German. Go figure. Anyway, you have that family, and when Queen Elizabeth dies, there's to be a successor from within that family. And there's these rules. I think Prince Charles sort of messed things up a little bit with his dalliance, but there's these rules of how the power is to pass from one generation to the next, usually to the oldest son and then on down. And oftentimes when you see one king be assassinated by a rival, the first thing the rival does is kill all his sons so that there's no claim. The dynasty is brought to a close, and now it's going to be replaced by another family, this new guy, and it's his boys, his sons, that will now be kings. And Scripture oftentimes uses the idea of an earthquake, a shaking of the land, to illustrate the what we would call the political, the dynastic upheavals that take place when something like that happens. Well, remember what has happened as David comes to power. that Saul and three of his oldest sons are slain on Mount Gilboa by the Philistines, the army of Israel is scattered. I mean, the Philistines have invaded the Jezreel Valley, right in the heart of Israel. It's the breadbasket of Israel. The army of Israel has met them at Mount Gilboa and have been defeated, and now the army has fled across the Jordan. In fact, from here on out, we find that the power of the remnant, sort of Saul's army, is over across the Jordan River in a place called Mahanaim, over there on the brook Peniel. That becomes sort of the power center way across the Jordan. And so, in other words, the description here in these first three verses would fit that scenario very, very well. First of all, God has deserted them. And you must remember that in the Old Testament age, that a battle was more than a war between two rival nations. Because you have this nation has its gods, and Israel has its God. And when a nation is defeated, it's not just the nation that's defeated, it's their God that is defeated. You follow how that works? For instance, when David went down in the Valley of Elah to fight Goliath, what does Goliath do? He curses David by the names of his gods. What does David do? He turns around and does the same thing to Goliath. I mean, Goliath says, "Come here, little boy. Come on over here. I'm going to feed you to the birds." What does David do? Is he intimidated? He says, "You don't realize, Buster, you don't know who you're fighting against here. I don't come to you like you come to me. I come to you in the name of the God of Israel, and I'm going to cut your head off." Now, that's pretty strong talk out of a little boy when he's standing there facing down a giant. But notice that it's more than just a battle between individuals or a battle between armies. It's a battle between gods. Do you realize that David was undefeated? He's something and oh, I don't know how many battles he fought, but he never got whipped. And the reason was because God was on their side. We saw just this past Tuesday morning the first battles that he fights against the Philistines as he comes to be king over all of Israel, that God gives him specific directions of what he's to do. The first time they go against the Philistines, he said, "Just charge them. Just plow right into them." And that's what he did, and they won. Well, the Philistines come back, and this time he says, "Circle around behind them, and when you hear the sound of marching up in the tops of the mulberry trees, attack them." And that's what he does, and they win. In other words, God gives him specific directions. Here's how you fight the battle. And David, we see from the beginning, much unlike Saul, who was given specific instructions for how he was to fight the Amalekites and didn't follow them, remember, David follows the instructions to a T, and he's never beaten, never whipped. So, you understand that to be defeated, like the Israelites were on Mount Gilboa, is an utter calamity. He talks about them drinking the wine of astonishment, the wine of amazement. They, in other words, they just can't process the fact that their army went against the Philistines and got whooped. Now, I mean, we got enough folks that, you know, after Super Bowl Sunday, they're astonished that their team got beat. They can't imagine a thing. But remember that this has far greater consequences. Not only now have the Philistines invaded the heart of their nation, and there's no army to stop them. They can raid, they can do whatever they want. But it means that somehow the gods of the Philistines seem to have triumphed over the God of Israel. But in actuality, what has happened? God has departed from Saul. Remember reading that in the account of Saul? The reason that Israel's armies are defeated is because God has left them. He has deserted them. Look at verse 1. "You have cast us off. You have scattered us." This wasn't the Philistines that did this to us. You did it to us. In other words, our God has deserted us. He has left us to ourselves in battle, and therefore we've been defeated. So there is this tremendous political upheaval. Not only is there like an earthquake, the dynasty of Saul all but brought to an end. There is one son, Ishbosheth, that Abner, Saul's commander-in-chief, installs as king over there in Mahanaim. But it's not long before he's assassinated. He's taking a nap one afternoon. A couple of guys come in pretending to sort of tidy up the place. And they, you know, the stab him under the fifth rib. They got real good at hitting that fifth rib. I don't know if that's five from the top or five from the bottom, but it seemed to do the job. And they cut off his head and brought his head to David in Hebron, and David had him put to death for touching the Lord's anointed. In other words, but the point is that Saul's dynasty was brought abruptly to an end. So there is this earthquake. Not only is there an earthquake, a political upheaval, but there is now a breach. You know what I mean by a breach? A division. A breach is like a dam that has a crack in it and the water pours through the crack. And so the land has not only been shaken, but now the land is divided because for the next several years, for about 7 years, there is a civil war in Israel. We learn that David and his men, or it's actually David wasn't with them, but it's Joab and David's army, go up to a place called Gibeon. There's a pool there. It's still there today. A big, it's about 40 feet across, about 60 feet deep. Big sort of cistern dug down into solid rock where they store water. And Joab and the men of David got over on one side, and Abner, with Saul's remnants, are over here on the other side. And they just sort of have a staring contest for a day or so. And finally they say, okay, here's what we'll do. We'll pick out 12 men from each side and let them go over and play. Now, when they said go over and play, they weren't talking about having a soccer game. It's basically, you send over 12 guys and we'll send over 12 guys and we'll see who's victorious. And David's 12 guys, I guess you could say they slaughtered them that day. They literally slaughtered them, and the flight was on. They chased the remnants of Saul's army almost clear across the Jordan River. So now there develops a civil war that goes on for several years until Ishbosheth, Saul's remaining son, calls Abner on the carpet for going into his father Saul's concubine. And Abner takes great offense at this. He says, Am I a dog's head? And maybe you understand what an insult that is, to call somebody a dog's head after you hear Jake's description of the dogs in Israel. But Abner says to Ishbosheth, I mean, Abner's the guy who put the crown on Ishbosheth's head. He's the one who anointed him king. He's the power behind the throne. And here Ishbosheth is calling him on the carpet over having this fling with his father's concubine. And Abner says, okay, that cuts it. That's it. Am I a dog's head? After all I've done for you, you're going to treat me this way about a woman? Sorry, women, but that would be about the way he'd say it. You mean you're going to call me on the carpet over a woman? And so he says, I'm taking the rest of the kingdom and I'm going to deliver it to David. I'm the power broker. I'll take the rest of the kingdom. And Ishbosheth, I mean, here's a guy telling you he's about to commit treason, and Ishbosheth is powerless to stop him. So eventually, Abner goes to David, offers to bring the entire nation under his rule. So the breach is finally healed, but for 7 years there is a civil war in Israel. There is a division. Mahanaim was where Saul's army, the remnants of it, are based. Hebron is where David and his power structure is based. And it won't be for a while before Jerusalem is conquered by David's men and the nation solidified once again. So you get the picture. This is an apt description in these first three verses of the great upheaval that has taken place when Saul bit the dust there on Mount Gibeah. But notice now things have changed. Starting in verse 4, we see now the deliverance that God has given the nation of Israel. And David describes it like this: Thou hast given a banner to them that fear thee, that it may be displayed because of the truth. A banner, and the word here in Hebrew is translated by a number of ways. Sometimes it's called an ensign, sometimes it's called a pole. The idea is, in warfare, in ancient times, they would use signals, they would wave flags, and the flag would indicate something. The flag would communicate something to the troops. Sometimes it's like everybody rally around the flag boys. Here's the guy with the flag waving the flag, and the flag, whatever's on that flag, would mean something to the troops. And this means this is where their king is, this is the rallying point, that kind of thing. That's the way you would communicate. And so notice that what David is saying here is that God has given a banner to those who fear you. Now, we'll talk at length well, not at length, but we'll mention this again as we get. We'll probably talk about it in length. You can pretty well put this down, okay? But we're going to come back to this at the close and talk about it before we finish. But just notice that what he's saying is that God has given to David now a banner that becomes the rallying point for all of those who fear God. In other words, all those who trust in God, all those who believe in God, they are now brought together under God's banner. What is the little chorus we sing? You brought me into your banqueting table. Your banner over me is love. Okay, that's the idea. Here is an ensign, a signal pole, and the people, those who fear God, gather themselves together under this banner. And notice verse 5, that thy beloved, and the beloved here would seem to speak of David himself, that thy beloved may be delivered, save with thy right hand and hear me. So we have David basically saying that although the nation has been scattered, it's been shaken, it's been divided, that now God is bringing the nation back together under this banner, and that he is going to save David, his beloved. And notice that now David is rejoicing. In other words, notice the whole tone has changed. You had this disaster going on in the first three verses, and now the disaster, the breaches are being healed, the nation brought back together under the banner, under David's leadership. And now notice the triumph that God gives David, starting in verse 6. God has spoken in His holiness, I will rejoice. And he begins to list a number of places. He says, I will divide Shechem and meet the valley of Succoth. The Feast of Succoth. That's Feast of Tabernacles, right? Yoo-hoo, right? The Feast of Succoth. You're looking. I keep thinking people are looking at me, and they ain't looking at me. They're looking up there, yeah. The Feast of Succoth. That's the Feast of Tabernacles. In the fall. Well, Succoth means tabernacles. And notice we've got a couple of names here. Shechem is that ancient place where where Abraham first entered the Promised Land. It's right there between those two mountains, Mount Ebal and Mount Gerizim, that we've talked about in central Israel. It's this ancient city. Succoth, the Valley of Succoth, was the place where Jacob, when he came back from his uncle Laban's, and remember Esau met him and he gives him a bunch of stuff. The reason it's called Succoth is that this was the place where Jacob built his booths to put his cattle, put his livestock. And so notice these are ancient places and they're up there in the north. In other words, what is noticeable about this is that David's power base, you know, we're used to this, aren't we? We go to a political convention and you nominate somebody for president of the United States, say from Chicago, for instance, and you assume that means he can deliver Illinois in the election, right? You get somebody from California or somebody from Texas, you assume that they can deliver their home state because that's their power base. That's where they have the most support. Well, David's support basically is coming from the southern part of the country, the tribe of Judah. That's his home base. That's his home. He's a Judah. He's a hometown boy from Bethlehem. And so most of his support and where he reigns for his first 7 years is in Judah. But notice that these locations are to the north. They're up there in the other side where Saul's son Ishbosheth reigned. And to say that, and notice the language here, that he will divide Shechem, he will meet, that means measure out, the valley of Succoth. In other words, the point is, if you have the right to divide something and to measure something, it indicates that you are the sovereign over it. You're the fellow who can dispense who gets the property because you're the ruler. And so this northern area that was the rival area to David's rule is now under David's control, and he's the one who divides it and meets it out. He's going to give a piece to you, Charlie. He's going to give a piece to you, Mark. He's the king. He's sovereign over this area. Notice as well, we go on in verse 7, Gilead is mine. Now, Gilead was the part across over on the other side of the Jordan, the east side of the Jordan River. Manasseh is mine. Ephraim, he said, is also the strength of my head. Now, those are all those areas to the north. That's where the main population of Israel was up there. In fact, at one time, I can't remember the figures in David's day, but at one time when the nation divided after Solomon's reign, the northern nation of Israel outnumbered the southern nation of Judah 2-1. There was twice as much population in the north as there was in the south. So notice that this is where the real population of Israel is, up there to the north, and now this has been given into David's hands, into David's control. He mentions Judah is my lawgiver. It's like the nation, like a body, has different parts, has a head. Notice who was the head here? Ephraim, the strength of my head. Judah is my lawgiver. That's where the law is going to come forth, out of Judah. And then notice there's these three countries that are not Israelite places, Moab, Edom, and Philistia. And it's almost comical what's said about them. Number one, he says, Moab is my washpot. Is my washpot. Now, the washpot is what the servant, the slave, used to wash the feet of somebody. I don't know whether to bring this up or not. I always hesitate to look at my wife because I know she'll say, don't say it. But when I was a little bitty kid, I'd go stay with my grand folks over in Wiley, Texas, as poor as church mice. And in the cold, they had an outhouse, but in the cold winter, it's too cold to go out to the outhouse. So we had the pot. I have that pot. That was one of the goodies that came to me. I have a lot of good memories associated with that pot. Okay? What's that? Moving right along, yeah. But the point is that Moab, and again, remember it's those Moabites over there on the other side of the Jordan that gave him so much trouble. Moab is now my washpot. This is the slave's job of washing up. This is where you keep the trash, the refuse, you see. So, in other words, Moab is under my control, and that's going to be my washpot. They're going to be my servants. They're going to be my slaves. And notice then he says about Edom, on Edom, I'm going to cast out my shoes. Now, I realize that to us, a shoe doesn't have a lot of attachment, you know, a lot of symbolism with it. But to the ancient world, the shoe had a lot of attachment. You may remember that the Levirate law, that if a woman's husband dies, that it is the duty of his brother to marry her and raise up children in the name of her brother, in the name of the dead brother. Y'all remember that law? Do you remember what happens that if he refuses to do it? Let's say she's ugly as a tree stump or something, you know, I don't know. Whatever. And we have a case of that, don't we, in the case of Ruth, where the nearer kinsman refuses to marry Ruth for whatever reason. He says, I don't want to mess up my inheritance. But, you know, Hollywood always portrays Ruth as the beautiful movie star. Well, she was just a field hand, you know, out begging, working in the fields. I'm not sure she was all that beautiful. But anyway, for whatever reason, this guy doesn't want to do it. Well, in that case, they were to take off their shoe and shake it at him. The shoe, in fact, the Muslims today, you don't sit with your feet crossed where you show the bottom of your shoe to a Muslim. That is an insult. So the shoe, and to throw a shoe at somebody, I mean, this is about as low as you can go. Didn't they just have that happen over in the Middle East? Where was that? It was in the... They threw it at George Bush in a press conference just a week ago somewhere. They took their shoes off and threw it at somebody. One of the places, Egypt, one of the places where there's turmoil over there in the Middle East. But yeah, the big publicized one was during a press conference and George Bush was speaking and the guy takes his shoe off and throws it at him. I mean, that's, in other words, this is low as you go. And notice that David is saying, well, Edom, you know, those little Edomites, that's where I'm going to throw my shoes. I'm just going to park my shoes over there in Edom. So in other words, they will be totally under my rule. And then this third statement, Philistia, triumph thou because of me. There's a couple of different ways of looking at it. One theory is that what this means is that Philistia, and this is the old land of the Philistines, where Goliath came from, that Philistia will be so dominated by David and Israel that the only way Philistia will ever triumph again is if David triumphs. They will triumph in his triumph. Or some render it as a question, Philistia, you're going to triumph over me? In other words, the point is, you will be so subjugated that you don't even have a prayer. Yes, Mark?
In my ESV translation,
yeah, obviously it means that David will be victorious over Philistia as well. And so it may be a taunt, Philistia, are you going to triumph over me? Or it may be that you are so thoroughly subjugated that the only way you'll ever triumph again is if I triumph. That's how the King James reads. Charles? Well, this, what David is doing is clearly attributing all of this to God. That is clear. That's what that first phrase of verse 6 does make clear. But I'm not sure the rejoicing going on here in that the dividing. I mean, yes, it is God doing it, but it would seem to be that it is given to David as his prerogative now that he's king. I mean, there's various ways you can look at the language. But the bottom line, you arrive at the same conclusion, that it is speaking of the fact that the nation that was once scattered, was running before its enemies, shaken like an earthquake, divided into civil war, has now been brought together under the rulership of David, and that God is blessing the rule and the kingdom of David by subjugating their enemies. And that then is what makes the inscription make sense. That the inscription is speaking of the final battles against the Syrian and Edomite armies that brought that finally to pass, that now all of Israel and all the adjacent countries have been brought under the rulership of David himself. Then verse 9, we have yet another question here. Who will lead me or bring me into the strong city? Who will lead me into Edom? And it's a rhetorical question. We're supposed to know the answer. But in case we're too dumb to figure out a rhetorical question here, he answers in verse 10, "Wilt not thou, O Lord, who hast cast us off, thou, O God, who didst not go out with our armies?" In other words, the sense is, the God who had cast us away, the God who didn't go with our armies in previous days, is now going with us, and he's the one who will lead us into what he calls here the strong city and lead me into Edom. Now, if you're talking about Edom, I don't know how well you know your geography here. If you're talking about a strong city in Edom, what city comes to mind? Almost impregnable city. You can guess. That's wrong. But anyway. Jericho, that's what you said, right? No, not Jericho. We're talking about Edom. Now, Edom's south. Edom is, you know, the Edomites, that's the descendants of Esau. And there's a notable city you can still visit today. In fact, if you saw Raiders of the Lost Ark, you saw the city prominently displayed. Well, for sure you'll get that. Petra. That's exactly right. There is a winding canyon that leads into Petra. In fact, in some places it's so narrow that it is said that two men can stand shoulder to shoulder. That's all that can stand there, the pass into Petra. And if you remember, well, if you don't remember the geography, you remember the movie, all the carved things up the walls of the city of Petra. It was considered absolutely impregnable, that nobody can conquer Petra. And yet notice that what David is saying is, you are the God, the same God who had given us over to our enemies, allowed us to be scattered. You'll be the God who will lead me into the strong city of Edom. So all of this is talking about the great reversal of fortune, we would say, the reversal of circumstances that the God who was against us and we were scattered, running before enemies, is now with us, and all our enemies are brought under our subjection. And so, we come to the conclusion in verse 11 and 12, give us help from trouble, for vain is the help of man. Man's help doesn't amount to a hill of beans. We need help from you. We need your power. Now notice that David had just had a good instance of seeing how vain man's help was, because the Ammonites had gone and hired them, a bunch of mercenaries from Syria, to come down and help them to fight off the Israelites. And guess what? Didn't work, did it? God was with the army of Israel. And so the help of man did not advantage them. And so David is pleading for God's help, and then declaring that through God we will do valiantly, courageously, we will tread, or I think the word literally means trample. Trample down our enemies. Now I said I was going to come back to this banner up there in verse 4. This ensign, this flag. That God has given to us a flag to be the rallying point, I guess you would call it, of those who fear God in Israel. And just a couple of other places that it's interesting to note this. First of all, Isaiah. In Isaiah 11, I want you to realize what we're talking about and who we're talking about here. Isaiah 11, verse 1, there shall come forth a rod out of the stem of Jesse, and a branch shall grow out of his roots. Now, who are we talking about? Jesus. It's the Messiah. And notice that this is speaking of Jesse, David's father, but this is roughly 300 years after the time of David. David's dead and gone. But notice that the prophet is saying there's going to come forth a rod out of the stem of Jesse. It's sort of like that Jesse's tree has got cut off like a stump, but there's going to be a shoot that comes out of that stump, and a branch shall grow up out of his roots. And if you know anything about the Old Testament, this term, the branch, is used over and over again to speak of the coming Messiah. Notice in verse 2, the Spirit of the Lord shall rest upon him. This branch is going to be him, a person. The Spirit of wisdom and understanding, the Spirit of counsel and might, the Spirit of knowledge and of the fear of the Lord. In other words, this is clearly speaking of the Anointed One, the Messiah, the Christ, who is anointed with the Spirit of God coming out of Jesse's roots. Then skip down. We don't have time to look at the whole passage here. In verse 10, in that day there shall be a root of Jesse who shall stand for an ensign of the peoples. It's the same Hebrew word here as the word banner back in Psalm 60. This one who is the branch will be an ensign, a signal flag, a pole. And notice who's going to be gathered to him. In other words, I said this is like in a battle. You wave the flag and the troops rally. That's the rallying point. The troops rush to that spot. They rally under the banner of their king. He shall stand for an ensign of the peoples. To him shall the Gentiles seek, and his rest shall be glorious. It shall come to pass in that day that the Lord shall set his hand again the second time to recover the remnant of his people, and he's going to bring them out of their captivity. Notice verse 12, and he shall set up an ensign for the nations, and shall assemble the outcast of Israel. In other words, Jews and Gentiles are going to come when he waves the flag, when he waves this signal. Both Jews and Gentiles are going to be gathered out of captivity unto him. You get the sense of it? Now, we don't have time to go into the detailed instruction, but just notice that it's that same idea, that God has given to his people a banner, an ensign. And here in Isaiah, the ensign is a person. It's the Messiah. And to this ensign, both Jews and Gentiles, those who fear the Lord. That's what it was in Isaiah 60, right? All those who fear the Lord, whether they're Jews or Gentiles, will be gathered out of their captivity unto him. And then one other text I won't have you turn there for the sake of time, but it's back in the book of Numbers in chapter 21 that Israel is griping and complaining, and God sends a bunch of poisonous snakes into the camp. And Moses cries out to God. The people are dying left and right. And what's he told to do? Put a brass snake on a nace, a pole, an ensign. Same word. Put a snake on a pole. And when you're bit, go look at that snake on the pole. Now, why is that significant? It's not significant because I say it is, but because Jesus in John 3 uses that incident to illustrate what He has come to do. As Moses lifted up the serpent in the wilderness, even so must the Son of Man be lifted up. And later on, John's going to explain by the term lifted up, he's speaking of the manner of Christ's death, His cross. As Moses lifted up a serpent on a pole, an ensign, the flag, the banner, so I must be lifted up, that whosoever believes in me will have eternal life. That Christ is basically saying that snake on a pole, that banner, that ensign, to which who gathers around that pole? It's snake-bit Israelites dying, who have gathered around that pole to gaze, to look on the one hanging there, as inexplicable as it seems. Why a snake of all things? Why a brass snake? Well, He made Him, as Jerry reminded us over the weekend, He made Him who knew no sin to become sin for us. In other words, the one hanging on that pole is bearing the judgment that I should have received. And the life is now being brought and communicated to me as I look. And Jesus makes it clear it's a look of faith upon the one hanging on that pole. So God's going to raise up an ensign. He's going to give a signal. We have an expression. I'm going to run this up the flagpole and see who salutes. God's going to put His Son on a cross and He's going to see who is gathered out of all the nations, Jews, Gentiles, all they who fear God gathered to that ensign are going to come together in faith to gaze on the one who hangs on that cross. Sarah sang for us that wonderful poem of John Newton, and that's really the theme of it. I saw one hanging on a tree in agony and blood. That's the heart and soul of what it is. The preaching of the gospel, Paul says, is the preaching of the cross. That's our job when we stand in the pulpit, is to take that ensign and wave it and see who salutes. See who comes running. Snake-bitten Israelites, snake-bitten folks, people who are dying come running to gather around God's signal pole. Well, we'll go on next time, Psalm 61, but interesting stuff, wonderful stuff. Again, even though this is speaking of incidents that are taking place in David's day, it still has ramifications for us in our day. It's prefiguring the times of great David's greater son, Jesus Christ, the Messiah.